All right, let's go ahead and open up to John. We're going to look at especially verse 23 here. We've come through John. Jesus must needs go to Samaria. I suggested if we leave the traditional explanation aside for at least a little while and look at it from a different perspective, he didn't must needs go to Samaria for an evangelism of a particularly sinful woman. That's kind of the traditional approach. He could have found a particularly sinful woman anywhere in Galilee and Jerusalem. As a matter of fact, in just a couple chapters, John 8, he's going to encounter a woman we actually know committed adultery. So he doesn't must needs go to Samaria in order to evangelize a sinful woman. He could have done that anywhere. We looked at it from the standpoint of God's prophetic program, and these first four chapters especially presenting to the disciples, training the disciples about how Israel's national salvation is going to occur. It began in Galilee, then he started his journey from Galilee. He went to Jerusalem, he went to Judea, and then he must needs go to Samaria, because that completes the kind of little picture of the salvation of the nation that he's putting on here to train his disciples how the nation of Israel is going to be saved. One of the aspects of the salvation of the nation of Israel is and her restoration into being the nation God designed her to be and the conduit of blessings to the rest of the world is that the nation has to be reunified. Ezekiel 37, we looked at the stick of Ephraim, Samaria, has to be rejoined to the stick of Judah, and forming one nation again. And so that's what we're coming to when we get into this section. He must needs go. And it's to complete the picture of Israel's national salvation. He shares with her this little bit on living waters and comparison to Jacob's well water. And she can't quite make the leap from the physical water to the spiritual water. So Jesus gives her a sign. And he demonstrates that he miraculously knows her whole past history. As summed up in those six men. And she picks up on it. And she immediately says, he displayed a miraculous prophetic sign. She picks up on it right away. And she says, I see you're a prophet. And for her, no doubt, that prophet would be the prophet that Moses spoke about, because the Samaritans only use the five books of Moses. And then the connection there, when they thought of the prophet like unto Moses, they also tied that. They thought that was the same person as the Messiah and the Christ. So when she starts thinking about that, it heads her down the avenue toward Messiah Christ, and Jesus is going to lead her there. And once she's thinking of the prophet and the Messiah, to me, she asks a very legitimate question. She asks about the proper place of worship. That seems to me, if you have a prophet of God who might be the Messiah, the Christ, who's going to tell you all things, she's going to say that a couple verses later, what else would she talk to him about? I mean, you know, the traditional view is that she changes the subject to religious talk, you know, this old controversy, and just to change subjects from her embarrassing past. I don't think that's what's going on at all. She asked a legitimate question. She has an actual point. She says, our fathers worshipped here on Mount Gerizim. And if you, we looked 1 week at this, and she's right. Abraham worshipped there. Jacob worshipped there. Joshua, the divine replacement for Moses, the books they especially revered, he worshipped in Mount Gerizim. Her point is, I think she has a very good point. Why is it wrong for us to worship here? And a little bit of the church tradition goes back farther. You know, in having Jerusalem the place, that just goes back to David. Worshipping on Mount Gerizim goes all the way back to Abraham. And so I think she has a point. It's a wrong point, but we all have many wrong points. Jesus is going to straighten her out and explain why Jerusalem and Judea is the spot. We looked at that last week. But I think she had a point there. And he's going to keep going, and he's going to keep leading her. He leads her through this place of worship. That's what we particularly focused on last week. And he's going to lead her on now to show that the place of worship really isn't the primary question she and the Samaritans and the Judeans and all Israel should be asking. Worship isn't primarily a place. Worship is primarily a person. And he's going to lead her to him. So he's going to spring off this worship thing. He's going to kind of close it off. He says, no, true worship, salvation is of the Jews. True worship is of flows out of Jerusalem and Judea. And he says the Samaritans don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what they worship. And why don't they know? Well, because they only use the five books of Moses. They've thrown away the rest of the scriptures of the Old Testament. They don't recognize God's progressive revelation that led to the establishment of Jerusalem and the temple there as being God's designated spot of worship. And that now leads to verse 23. And we're going to spend some time now looking at this hour concept. And I think this is important. We're not going to do the traditional thing. We're going to look at it from the standpoint of right division, recognizing that the Gospel of John isn't for us in the dispensation of grace, isn't about the body of Christ. This hasn't come on the scene yet, won't come on the scene till Paul comes on the scene a few years later. And we're going to look at it from the point of right division. We're not going to go to Paul and bring Paul into John, make John say what Paul says. We're going to take John and use his Old Testament references to explain what John is talking about. And one of those Old Testament references is this hour concept. We see it in verse 21. Jesus saith unto her, and I think it's important to also recognize the similarities. You know, we keep reading and we forget some things, but when he knows this woman's whole past history, that's kind of like Nathaniel back at the end of chapter 1. Remember, Nathaniel's under that tree, and he hears about Christ, and what does he say? What good thing can come out of Nazareth? He goes, Jesus tells him he's an Israelite without guile, and he says he knows what he was doing under the fig tree. And then all of a sudden, that was a sign. He's a sign pointing to him that this Jesus isn't just a someone from Nazareth. He's someone that's special from Nazareth, the Christ, the Messiah. And Nathanael, immediately after seeing that sign, Jesus knowing his past life, immediately says the Christ, the Son of God. Well, here you have the Samaritan woman, and she's not really getting what he's saying. And then he goes and he does this sign, and he knows her whole past life story, kind of similar to Nathaniel. He knows her whole life story. And she immediately recognizes he's a prophet. And she springs off that. That leads to worship, the place of worship, which leads to the person of worship, which leads to the Christ, the Messiah. And the Lord's going to end it all. His last words to her is going to be, I am. He's the embodiment of the I am Jehovah God of Israel. He gives her that name. And he says, it's an incomplete thought, an incomplete sentence. Just fill it in with whatever you need. I am the source of salvation to Israel. And so that's the progression that's going on through here. But there's another similarity just right after the Nathanael encounter in chapter 2. Look at verse 21. Jesus saith unto her, Woman. Now, where have we heard the word woman before when Jesus is talking? And when he's talking, let's just finish this phrase here. Woman, believe me, the hour cometh. You remember back in chapter 2 with Mary at the wedding in Cana, and the wine runs out. She's telling Jesus, and what does Jesus tell her? He says to Mary, he says, Woman, my hour has not come. And here he tells a Samaritan woman, Woman, there's a coming hour. I think we need to recognize these similarities that kind of are being played back and forth, and we're going to see them really kind of interwoven throughout the whole book. So we looked at this coming, the hour cometh, and last time. And now in verse 23, we have the hour cometh and now is. So we have a little progression on that concept. So I think it's worthwhile looking at the hour cometh. He's one in verse 21, it's the hour cometh when they are not going to be worshiping in Jerusalem or Mount Gerizim. And we looked at that last week and looked at that. There's an actual point in the middle of the midst of the tribulation period when the Antichrist takes over that temple and he sets himself up as God and demands worship from everyone in the world. And the ones who worship the one true God are going to be scattered out. And a lot of them are just going to be scattered out among the Gentiles, away from it. They won't be worshiping there. That's an hour. And now in verse 23, the hour cometh. And now is, and there's another hour coming when something in particular has to be really placed as something of great importance. But the hour cometh. What's that thing they're going to have to do in the future? He's already talked about the coming hour during that tribulation period, especially that last 3.5 years. Now he's talking about that coming hour, the same kind of time frame. And what are they going to need to do? And that verse 23 will finish the verse. When the true worshiper shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. There's coming an hour, and I'd suggest it's this hour in the tribulation period, especially that last 3.5 years, when in order for them to survive that tribulation period, they're going to have to do what it says here. They're going to have to continue worshiping the Father in spirit and in truth. But notice when it says this, but the hour cometh and now is. That's what's required right now in Jesus' earthly ministry. There's coming a time when it's going to be exceedingly important, especially in the tribulation period, especially that last half of the tribulation period, when they are going to need to worship the Father in spirit and truth through faith, by believing, and remain committed that they're going to reach the end, continue to the end, to Christ's second coming, when he's going to deliver them from all the evil. But now he says in verse 23, they'll really need it out then, but it starts now in Christ's earthly ministry. They really need it now. And it's important. It begins right now. So we'll look at that in more detail. But let's play out this hour concept a little. The hour in John corresponds to the Old Testament use of the word time. It's the Hebrew word, and I have no idea how to pronounce it, M-O-E-D, and referred to an appointed or fixed time or times when God would meet together with Israel. Used of Israel's prophetic clock, especially by the prophet Daniel, but by other prophets as well. And it's also used in reference to the prophetic calendar, the times of the festivals. So the observance of these times externally without faith is condemned by God. It's important to realize this idea, worshiping the Father in spirit and in truth. That in spirit concept, the inner person, the heart, and we'll see this all played out in a little bit here. The inner, it has to come from a heart of faith. Anything done that's apart from a heart of faith is condemned by God. Now let's go to Isaiah 1:14. And then we're going to go to Daniel and just look at a few things there. But first, let's go to Isaiah 1:14. This is the predicament of the nation. They were doing these things externally as fleshly endeavors. They just turned the religious system of Israel in the days of Isaiah, and really before that, but here we're talking about the days of Isaiah. They've turned Israel's whole religious system into a vain religious system. It's just for entertainment. They just go through the motions. It's just a vain religious system. And look what he says in Isaiah 1:14. Your new moons and your appointed feasts, the times, are the new moons and Sabbath. where are we at here? Verse 14, your new moons and your appointed feasts, my soul hateth. They are trouble unto me. I am weary to bear them. And so anything done through fleshly endeavor without coming from a heart of faith isn't acceptable to God. It can even be the right things. They do the sacrifice in the right way or something. But if they're not doing it from a heart of faith, they're condemned by God. God doesn't want it. And so let's go back on the way to John. Let's look at a few things in Daniel on how he uses this this hour concept. Go to Daniel. And I'm just going to read through a few of these. I don't see any point to touching them all. You can certainly go look at them. Let's look at 7:22. Daniel 7, verse 22. My point in these is pulling these verses out isn't to explain all the details of what's going on here. All these have something to do with end time events, especially that tribulation period, but also the earthly ministry of Christ. And he says here, Daniel 7:22, until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. My point in bringing this out, again, is not to develop this whole passage. My point is there's an appointed time when the saints are going to inherit the kingdom. There's an appointed time, what John calls that appointed hour, appointed time in Daniel. Go to verse 25. Verse 25, and he shall speak great words against the Most High and shall wear out. This is that Antichrist in the tribulation period. And he will wear out the saints of the Most High and think to change times and laws. He's going to try and change the times. Remember, this our whole fifth course of punishment is set up on a time. Remember, in Israel's prophetic program, there's no dispensation of grace. This isn't the timeline. In Israel's prophetic program, this is the timeline. Here we are at the Lord's earthly ministry, and everything's been on a time schedule. You had the first, the Babylonian captivity. Jeremiah said that's 70 years, 49 years under Medo-Persian rule. Time. Everything's on a prophetic clock, an hour. Then you had the 400 years of silence. You had the 34-year ministry of Jesus and the one-year extension of grace and peace that gets you all the way through the day of Pentecost. And when you get to that point, the only thing left on Daniel's time schedule is that tribulation period. And then you get out there, you read Revelation, and Revelation gives the number of days. Everything is on a time schedule. Everything is mapped out. And as Daniel says here, there's an appointed time. The saints are going to inherit the kingdom. There's a appointed time when the Christ is going to be cut off. There's an appointed time when the Antichrist is going to take over the temple in Jerusalem in the midst of that tribulation period. There's an appointed time for all these things. And that's the hour concept John is bringing out. Let's go to chapter 8, verse 17. Chapter 8, verse 17. We'll just read a couple more examples. They all are basically the same idea. Verse 17. Chapter 8, verse 17. So he came near where I stood, and he's been, there's an interpretation to the vision he had, and so forth. Verse 17. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell upon my face. But he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. He's going to get a vision that's going to talk about the time that things are going to happen in the end. Look at verse 19. And he said, behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation. That's that tribulation period. For at the time appointed, the end shall come. There's an appointed time for the end to come. Remember, Jesus even said, lest the days be shortened. There's a time. Everything's on an appointed time in Israel's prophetic program. Things aren't on an appointed time. At least we don't know it, if there is. for the dispensation of grace. But there is, in Israel's time schedule, there's five, or we're in the fifth course of punishment. That's all the courses of punishment there's going to be for the nation of Israel. And when we're in Jesus' earthly ministry, we're in the, there's five installments in the fifth course of punishment. And when we're in the earthly ministry of Christ, that's the fourth installment. There's only one installment left. And then Israel's indignation, Israel's punishments are going to be brought to an end, and they're going to be delivered into that nation, delivered from their enemies, and ushered into that kingdom. There's only one time left. There's only one one installment left, and that's that tribulation period. So they're on a time schedule. We're not on a time schedule today. And it's important to realize that. And so we can look at a couple more. Look at chapter 9, verse 25. Of course, chapter 9, we read last time. Here's the key verse, or one of the key verses anyway, verse 25. This is Daniel 9:25. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks, 49 years. It's a time and 70. And then after that, there's going to be a 70 and 2 week period. And that's a certain amount of time. And then look how he ends of it. And the wall, even in troublous times. Everything is on a time schedule. Everything's associated with a time, with an hour. Everything's related to that. Go to chapter 11, verse 27. We'll just do one or two more here. I think you're getting the hang of this. Chapter 11, verse 27. And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet at the end shall be at the time appointed. Verse 27. Well, we read verse 27. How about go back to verse 23. And after the league made with him, he shall work, for he shall not come up, shall be strong with the people. That's not, this is verse chapter 12. I'm sorry, I was in verse 11. Chapter 12, verse 23. That doesn't have. Oh, I'm reading the wrong notes here. Chapter 12, verse 1. And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble. Of course, we call it the great and terrible day of the Lord. There's going to be a time of trouble such as never was seen since there was a nation, even to the same time. And at that time, thy people shall be delivered, everyone that shall be found written in the book, and so forth. There we could go and multiply the references to time, but I'm just trying to point out it's that time concept, the appointed time, that carries over into John's hour. And now, based on that, let's go back to John. Oops. Let's go back to John and look at the hour concept. John 4 again. John 4. Now, sometimes John uses the word just generally, like we see in earlier in chapter 4, the sixth hour. I mean, he's not talking prophetically at that point. So he can use the word hour just as the time of, generally as the time of day. But in those significant moments when he's drawing attention to the time or the hour of something, it can have prophetic significance. And the main hour that he's talking about here is that has to do with Jesus's coming glorification through his death and resurrection. That's his hour that's coming. And we can look at that. My hour, his hour, has come here. Now, usually this is traditionally taught. We're going to set aside the traditional, but just to kind of bring it up, to set it aside, usually this is taught because they think John's about the body of Christ and the dispensation of grace. They say this is our, what Jesus is doing here in John 4, is he's basically getting rid of all the distinctions that were made in Israel's prophetic program. Jesus is getting rid of a literal Israel, a literal literal temple, a literal Jerusalem, a literal land of Israel. He's getting rid of that and has become a spiritual Israel, a spiritual Jerusalem, a spiritual land and all that. And guess who's replaced Israel? We have the church, the body of Christ. That's the usual traditional interpretation. Well, you need to throw that aside, at least set it aside, because I don't think that's what Jesus is doing at all. He's not throwing away. That's for people who have rejected Paul's distinct apostleship, so they don't rightly divide their scriptures, and so they read Paul into John and do away with Israel and her prophetic program and replace them with us in the body of Christ, and it just causes a mixed up mess. What I think he's talking about here is he's talking about these hours fulfill aspects of Daniel's time schedule. Hours in the time schedule, and I tried to demonstrate that in the last slide. So the hour here primarily in John has to do with Jesus's hour, his coming glorification through his death and resurrection. That's how he's going to be glorified. That's his coming hour. He calls it... When it's referring to that hour, it's either he refers to it and says, my hour, or someone else refers to it and they say it's his hours, his hour, referring to Jesus. And it always refers to Jesus' glorification through death and resurrection. And that's, of course, we read in Daniel 9:25 last week, after that 62-week time frame. But we also see it not only in Daniel. Psalm 23, of course, shows his glorification through the cross. He goes to that cross, suffers greatly, takes the sin of Israel onto himself at that cross to save his friends. But you see, none of the accounts in the Old Testament stop with the death. There's always a life afterwards. In Psalm 23, there's the life that comes after. Isaiah 53, there's a servant dies in a horrible way, but then he lives again to see his seed, to see those his followers, and to carry it through. So it's like his glorification through his death and resurrection. That cross, when they put him on the cross and lift him up on that cross, it's going to, I guess you could say, catapult him into the glory through his death and resurrection. He's going to ascend back to the Father, and he's going to, having glorified the Father is going to glorify him. And he's going to receive the glory, have returned to him the glory he had before creation, before, and he did this earthly ministry, before all that. Plus, and here's the thing you really need to realize, that he's going to be glorified in that way as a man, a glorified man, not just glorified God, but a glorified man now who can be mankind's savior and mankind's redeemer and deliverer. And so that's the hour that's usually referred to, and it's usually called my hour or Jesus's hour, if someone else is saying it, his hour, and it all has to do with that. And we see that several places in the Old Testament. But let's just look at some in John here where he refers, uses this hour concept of himself. Go to John 2. We mentioned this just a few minutes ago, his encounter at the wedding feast with his mother. And what does he say here, verse 4? This is John 2, verse 4. Jesus saith unto her, woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not come. When he refers to his hour, it's talking about his glorification through death and resurrection. And that's on Daniel's time schedule, because Daniel talks in Daniel 9:25 talks about that what Christ is going to do and the Messiah, when he's going to be cut off in the time schedule there. Let's look at a couple of other instances. Look at chapter 7, verse 30. And he says, then they sought to take him, but no man laid hands on him. This is at the Feast of Tabernacles, and they want to put him to death again, and they're going to try and capture him. Verse 30, and they sought to take him, but no man laid hands on him because his hour hadn't yet come, wasn't yet come. It's his hour again. Go to chapter 8, verse 20. These words spoke Jesus in the treasury, this treasury of the temple, as he taught in the temple, and no man laid hands on him before his hour hadn't yet, not yet come. But let's see the progression. So at this point, the early parts of the book of John, the hour hasn't yet come. Now go to chapter 12. Chapter 12, verse 23. Chapter 12, verse 23, and he says, and Jesus answered them, saying, the hour is come that the Son of Man should be glorified. He's talking about that hour, the glorification through his death and resurrection. Verse 27, now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this cause came I unto this hour. There's an appointed hour. That's why he doesn't, early in chapters 2 and since then, and no one could lay hands on him because his hour hadn't come. There's an appointed time, and it's associated with Daniel's time schedule when he's going to be cut off. An appointed hour. There's an appointed time. No one's going to take him earlier. It's going to come at the appointed time, the hour. And so you see that over and over again. Look at chapter 13, verse 1. Here we are, and he's together with the disciples, verse 1. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour was come. Now his hour has come. Within just a short amount of time, a few hours, he's going to be on that cross. Now his hour has come. And he says that he should depart out of the world. The appointed time has come unto the Father, having loved his own, which were in the world, and so forth. Go to chapter 17. This will be the final one. Chapter 17, verse 1. Here we are in the prayer of intercession with the Father. These words, this is John 17, verse 1. These words spoke Jesus and lifted up his eyes to heaven and said, Father, the hour is come. Glorify thy Son, and thy Son also may glorify thee. And so he's going to, that his hour, when he says it, it's my hour. It's that glorification through his death and resurrection. It leads to his ascension, return to the Father, and glorification now with the glory he had before, but as not just a God, but as a man. There's a glorified man in the heavenlies with a resurrection body, which ours will be like unto, a spiritual heavenly, 1 Corinthians 15 body, that ours will be like unto when we refer in Ephesians and Romans, our redemption of the body, redemption of the purchased possession. It'll be like unto that. All right. It's can also be used. So that's the big one in John. That's the big hour that kind of encompasses all the other hours. But there's other hours as well. So let's take a look at them. One is in reference to the disciples. Look at, we're in John, 17. So let's go to John 16. Just flip back a page. John 16, 32. John 16, 32, behold, the hour cometh. So here's a coming hour. Now, what's the coming hour he's referring to here? Let's just keep reading. Yea, is now come. So here's a coming hour, and it's here. There's an appointed time something was going to happen, and now the time is here. The time is here. It's going to happen within hours, over the next few hours. And he says, Behold, the hour cometh. This is chapter 16, verse 32. And yea, is now come that ye shall be scattered. He's talking to the disciples, his followers. Ye shall be scattered, every man to his own, and shall leave me alone. And yet I am not alone, because the Father is with me. Isn't that a beautiful? Now there you have an interdispensational truth. Everyone else left would leave him, but he's not alone. The Father is with him. There's an interdispensational truth. What a beautiful statement. And so it refers to the disciples. Now, let's look at a few other things. Let's keep your finger here. I'm going to put a bookmark here and go to Matthew. Matthew 26. Matthew 26, verse 31. Matthew 26, verse 31. And he says here, then saith Jesus unto them, all ye shall be offended because of me in this night, for it is written, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered. And that's an actual quote from Zechariah 13:7. So there is an appointed hour. Maybe we should just go back to Zechariah. It's just a few pages back. It's the second book from the end of the Old Testament there, just before Malachi. Why don't we go there and look at 13:7, Zechariah 13:7. Zechariah 13:7, and he said, awake, O sword, against my shepherd, and against the man that is my fellow, and saith the Lord of hosts, smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered, and I will turn my hand upon the little ones. There's going to be a group. They're going to be scattered out of Jerusalem. And there's going to be a portion that go to the wilderness, and they're going to be miraculously preserved in the wilderness. I think many others are going to be scattered out among the nations in that tribulation period. Because that's one of the things Christ does when he returns at the end of the tribulation period. He regathers the believing remnant of Israel from their graves in the amongst the Gentiles. They're not literally dead, but they're dead as a nation outliving among the Gentiles, and he regathers them together. But here it's talking about the scattering of the disciples. Here you have an appointed time prophetically prophesied by Zechariah years before, and now that time has reached its point. The hour was coming in John 2 and John 3 when the disciples would be scattered, but now when you get just before the cross here, and now the time has come, and he's going to fulfill that prophecy. The appointed time, the hour, will have come. It's also used in reference to the dead. Go back to chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 25. We could also add to this one that's pretty close to it, and that's our next section in John 4, the nobleman's son. And while the son apparently is ill, he says in there that he's nigh unto death, and then it says the nobleman's afraid he's already died. So there you have someone who's is on the verge of death if they haven't actually died at the end of chapter 4 there. But go to chapter 5 here. We have a more explicit account of it. Chapter 5, verse 25. Oh, I'm in Matthew still. We need to go to John. John 5. John 5, 25. John 5, 25. And verily, verily, I say unto you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live. So there's an appointed hour when the dead are going to be raised up again. And Jesus is going to give a foretaste. That's still a future hour. He says, I say unto you, the hour is coming. That's a future hour. There is going to be, for the most part, at Christ's second coming. During his earthly ministry, he's going to give a foretaste of that. He's going to give a little foretaste of that, and it's especially seen with Lazarus. He's going to give a foretaste just before that. So you have, there's an appointed hour when God is going to raise the dead. And Jesus is going to give a foretaste in his earthly ministry, and another time that we'll look at in a second. But there's an appointed time in the future. And he's just giving a picture of it here. Go to chapter 4. Well, you don't need to turn to chapter, or look at verse 28 and verse 5. In chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 28. Marvel not at this, for the hour is coming in which all that are in their grave shall hear his voice. That's a, there's an appointed hour for that. And let's look at one other instance of this. Go to, we already mentioned John 4:47. That's the nobleman's son. It doesn't say explicitly he was dead, but it did say he was nigh unto dead. And if he wasn't, he was nigh unto dead when the nobleman left, and the nobleman was afraid he'd actually died. But then we have 5:25, this coming, there's an appointed time when the dead are going to be raised. Now go to chapter 11. Here we have the Lazarus account. Chapter 11, verse 38. And we're not going to read the whole thing. Let's just go down to verse 44. John 11:44, and he that was dead came forth, Lazarus, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound with a napkin. Jesus said, loose him and let him go. And just go back to verse 39 and we'll see how long he's been dead. John 11:39, Jesus said, take ye away the stone. Martha, the sister of him that was dead, saith unto him, Lord, by this time he stinketh, for he hath been dead for 4 days. Jesus raises him. It's a foretaste. There's a time in the future when the dead are going to be raised. Jesus gives a little pictures of it. And let's look at another picture of it. This one back in Matthew. So let's swing back to Matthew again. Matthew chapter 27 this time. Chapter 27:52. Jesus is on the cross and he gives up the spirit. Verse 50. Matthew 27 verse 50. And Jesus, when he cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the spirit, the ghost. And behold, the veil of the temple was rent in two from the top to the bottom, and the earth did quake, and the rocks broke in half, and the graves were opened. And many bodies of the saints which slept arose and came out of their graves after his resurrection. Notice it's after the resurrection that this happened, and went into the holy city and appeared unto many, and so forth. And so we have this other hour, this coming hour when the dead are going to be raised up. It's going to be especially at Christ's second coming. That's going to be particularly important at that time, but Jesus gives a picture of it at this time. All right, let's go ahead and look at a couple instances here. So these are the ones where the big issue really is Christ's death, Christ's glorification through death and resurrection. But there's some other ones, and one of them is back to John. One of them is what we're talking about here in John 4. The hour is coming. When there won't, true believers won't be worshiping in Mount Gerizim, of course, because that's not the right place to worship, but they won't even be worshiping in Jerusalem. Myths of that week, there's a time coming when the Antichrist is going to take over the temple and demand all the world worship him, and true believers are going to be severely persecuted and scattered out from the place, and they won't be worshiping there, because the Antichrist will be there. That's 1 hour. No one will worship there. That's the myths of the tribulation period when Antichrist takes over the temple, demands the world's worship. He's going to scatter and persecute worshipers of the one true God. We won't go back to Daniel, but let's go to Matthew again. Keep your bookmark here. We've been back and forth to Matthew. Matthew 24, verse 15. Matthew 24, verse 15. This is the chapter. Remember, at the beginning of the chapter, he talked about the destruction of the temple. Now in verse 15, when ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel. That's back in Daniel 9:27. When you see that, stand in the holy place, whosoever readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. just flee. And they're going to be scattered abroad. All right. So there's an hour coming with that. I suggest that's what John is talking about here in John 4, verse 21, when there's coming a time, a coming hour when they won't be worshiping in that area at all. And that leads us now to verse 23. And we get this phrase again, but the hour cometh, there's a coming hour. But in this case, it's modified, and now is. There's something that's going to be extremely important in the coming future that they're going to have to do. They're going to have to worship God in spirit and truth. But it starts now. It starts with Christ's earthly ministry. It really starts all the way back in history, but it's important to start doing now. They're in the fourth installment of the fifth course of punishment. There's only one installment left, the tribulation period, and they need to get ready. They need to receive their Messiah King. They need to receive the one the Father has sent and thereby worship the Father in spirit and truth. And it's going to be especially important out in the future during that tribulation period. But it begins right now with Jesus' arrival on the scene. He's giving them an opportunity to respond before the coming day of the Lord, before that tribulation kicks in. But the problem kicks in because when they go through that tribulation period, it's going to be extremely important that just to survive, to make it to the end, as it says in Matthew, what they needed to do was worship, continue to worship God in spirit and truth, which is what we're talking about here in verses 23 and 24 of John 4. That's what's missing in Israel, faith, believing. That's the whole point of the book. Oh, keep your finger here. We go to the end of John 20. Go to John 20. He gives you the purpose of the whole book. John 20, look at verse 30. John 20, verse 30. And many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples that are not written in this book. But these are written that ye might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name, that I am Jehovah name, that he's going around, tabernacling around Israel, just like God did, the Lord did for Moses 1,500 years before. And he's going around Israel, the tabernacle of God, and he's proclaiming the name of the Lord. And the whole point of the signs and the proclaiming of the name of the Lord is that they might believe. That's the key ingredient that's missing from Israel's, the nation of Israel. They're run by a vain religious system that's going through the external activities, but doesn't believe from the heart. They don't worship from the heart, a heart of faith. And Israel, that's the main goal of John. Israel was trying to enter God's program, but they were entering through all the wrong doors, the doors of the false shepherds. And what they needed to realize, we've talked about this before, it's not enough to just have the law or have the scriptures have circumcision or any of that. Are you doing it? Are you responding from hearts of faith? Are you engaged with them? And probably the key thing to this, Paul's the one that explains this so clearly. We'll turn there, keep a bookmark in John, but let's go to Romans now. We'll just do a quick stop in Romans 10. This is the main problem with Israel at that time. This is at the time of Paul, but remember, Paul was just a few years after this, and Paul was part of that vain religious system of Israel that put Jesus to death. He's the one that was persecuting in the Acts period, in Acts 8 and 9, he was persecuting Christ because he was persecuting the church. At that time, the church, the assembly God was working with, was a believing remnant of Israel, and he persecuted them even unto death. He's part of that vain religious system. And look at the problem Paul says with Israel. This is Romans 10, verse 1. Romans 10, verse 1, Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved, for I bear them record. And see, there's no one better, we'll see in a minute, for bearing them record, because he was a part of it. Not just a part of it, he was the leader of it. A leader of it, anyway. For I bear them record. They have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. For they being ignorant of, now what are they ignorant of? They being ignorant of God's righteousness and going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves unto the righteousness of God. Let's see what that means. What does it mean? They were trying to establish their own righteousness, and in focusing on establishing their own righteousness, they missed out on the righteousness of God, which is by grace through faith, which is received by faith, participated in by faith. Go to Romans 2 now. This fantastic chapter that is oftentimes just kind of swept under the carpet. But we're not going to sweep it under the carpet. I'm not going to develop the whole chapter. We've done that in our study with Romans. But let's just bring out what Paul says here is one of the was the major problem with Israel. This whole chapter too has to do. He's going to begin if he especially is focusing on the Gentiles at the end of chapter one. He's going to shift now and start talking about the Jews in chapter two, he's going to warn the whole world, including the Jews, don't despise what God's doing now through the apostleship of Paul. Now, God, because to despise what God's doing through the apostleship of Paul and the grace he's dispensing through Paul's apostleship is to despise, verse 4, look at Romans 2, verse 4, is to despise the riches of his goodness and forbearance and long-suffering, not knowing that the goodness of God leads thee to repentance. To throw away Paul's distinct apostleship is to throw away the riches of God's long-suffering kindness and forbearance and goodness. And that just adds to the problem from chapter 1, verse 5, but after thy hardness and impenitent heart. Now, what did he say in chapter 2 was that belonged to all fallen humanity, Jew and Gentile alike. They had foolish, darkened hearts back in chapter 1. Now, he adds to that, now today, when you if you despise the distinct apostleship of Paul, you despise the riches of grace God's dispensing through that, you're gone from not only foolish and darkened hearts, but to hardened and unrepentant hearts. And then there's only one thing left if you do that. In verse 5, let's finish reading verse 5. And if that's the case, then you treasurest up unto thyself wrath against the day of wrath and revelation of the righteous judgment of God, and you're going to be judged, verse 16, in the day when God shall judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to my gospel. It's according to that faith component. Did you believe God from the heart? And see, that's the problem with Israel. When Paul writes Romans 2, and during Christ's earthly ministry, and during the centuries before that, going back to Isaiah, and before that even, all the way to the divided kingdom 1,000 years before, they've had this huge problem, and really going back to the Exodus, they've had the problem being lack of faith. That's the missing ingredient, that lack of faith component. And Paul brings that out here. There's so many things we could talk about in this chapter, but we'll just begin it. Look at verse, let's pick it up at verse 13. And we're just going to string this together. The point is here, the problem with Israel is they're going through the wrong doors. They're trying to enter the race at the wrong places. Paul explains in verse 13, for not the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law are justified before God. Go to verse 17. Behold, thou art called a Jew and restest in the law and make thy boast of God. So here you have, the issue isn't having the law. The issue isn't just having it. The issue isn't just hearing it. The issue isn't resting in it. verse 18, and knowest his will, and approvest the things that are more excellent, being instructed out of the law, and art confident that you, thou thyself art a guide to the blind, a light to them that are in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babes, which has the form of knowledge and of the truth of the law. See, they had the law, they heard the law, they rested in the law, they even taught the law. But there's one problem. See, none of those were the right doors. The right doors are given verse 21. Thou therefore which teachest another, teachest thou not thyself? Thou that preachest a man should not steal, do you steal? Thou that sayest, don't commit adultery, and so forth. And look at verse 23. Thou that makest thy boast of the law through breaking the law, you dishonor God. See, the key thing is here, they had the law, they heard the law, they rested in the law, they taught the law, but they didn't believe the law. Jesus is actually going to say that in John. He's going to say, if you believed Moses, you'd believe me. They didn't believe it, and so they weren't doing it. And it was all worthless. See, those are the wrong places. I've always used the illustration of a race. The only place you can enter a race is at the starting point, the starting block. If you enter the race at any other intersection, any other doorway on the racetrack, what are you? You're automatically disqualified from your first step on the race course. It doesn't matter how fast you are, how strong you are. It doesn't matter if you go around the track six times that takes everyone else and everyone else in the time it takes everyone else to go one time. None of that matters. If you didn't start at the starting block, you're automatically disqualified. Well, that's what was missing with Israel. We see this in Matthew 3 and throughout all the gospel accounts, the book of Matthew when we were going through. That's what Israel is missing. They're trying to enter the race at the wrong place. Abraham is the pattern to follow, and Abraham's starting point is that Abraham believed in the Lord, and the Lord counted his faith for righteousness. It all begins with faith. Then God started doing things with him. He took the promises he gave to Abraham and codified them into a covenant, and he gave him circumcision. He could be a picture of the future work of Christ on that cross by offering up Isaac. But it all began, Abraham gives the starting block, it's faith. And Israel was trying to enter God's race, God's program, through the wrong doors. They were trying to enter, we have the law. And they thought because they have the law, they're automatically involved in God's programs. They're automatically will enter the kingdom. They have circumcision. Let's see what Paul says about circumcision. Go down to verse 28. I'm still in Romans 2, verse 28. For he is not a Jew, which is one outwardly. It's not the external things that it begins with. Of course, they're important and they're valuable. He says that here too. They're valuable on their own, but only if they come from a heart of faith. Let's keep reading. Neither is that circumcision, which is outward in the flesh. See, that circumcision outward in the flesh only has value if, verse 29, but he is a Jew, which is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart. Now, see why I'm coming here. Remember our verse from John 4, 23? Those true worshipers will worship God in spirit and truth. Well, here you have, an explanation of what that means. He is a Jew, which is one inwardly, the inward man, the spirit. And you'll see that here in a second. And circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit. That's the word, that's the phrase we have over in John 4. And not in the letter, which is praise of not of men, but of God. So there you have, Paul kind of summarizes it. Go back now to John 4. So now when it says, but the hour cometh and now is when the true worshiper shall worship the Father in the spirit, in the heart, in from the inner man by faith. That's the only way you bring it into the heart. It's brought into the heart, into the spirit by faith. That's the starting point. That's what Israel's missing. They're doing things in the law. They're reading the law. They're resting in the law. They're teaching the law. They're doing the law in externals, but they're not doing it from hearts of faith. And Paul's point in chapter 2, and the issue isn't having circumcision or having the law or having the scriptures. It's believing in them and obeying them. True worshipers will worship the Father in spirit, in the inner man, through faith. It's not just having these things or just being. Here's another one that is often brought up, than being the natural descendant of Abraham. John the Baptist knocks that down in Matthew 3. See, they thought just being the natural descendants of Abraham through the line of Isaac and Jacob, that they automatically were part of God's program. They automatically would enter that kingdom. They automatically would be leaders in the kingdom. And John comes along and he says, no, it has to start from a hearts of faith. You have to believe. You have to start where Abraham started. The law didn't even come in Abraham's life. Circumcision came way later in his life. Even the Abrahamic covenant didn't come till later. The starting point is Abraham believed. God spoke to Abraham. Abraham believed God. God counted his faith for righteousness, justified before God and his tribunal unto eternal life, all individual personal sins forgiven. And now he, as one who belonged to God, God could make use of him, could give him opportunities to participate in his things. That's what Israel was missing. That's why Jesus brings it up here in chapter 4. The key thing, the starting point, the key thing that everyone in Israel, Samaritan, Judean, Galilean, anywhere in Israel needed to understand, is that their big failure of the vain religious system is that it didn't start with faith. Therefore, it was all vanity. It was all vain. That God condemned it, and it was worthless. And he's saying there's coming a time when you're going to go through that tribulation period, and you're going to need to be worshiping God in spirit and in truth, and that time has begun now for the nation of Israel. Saul, of course, is the complete picture of this. Maybe that would be a good place to pick it up next time. Saul will give us the exact explanation and illustration, I guess that'd be the best way to put it, of what this is going to happen. Saul is the ultimate example, that false worshiper, because he didn't worship in spirit and truth through faith, representing the fallen nation of Israel. And that's where we'll begin next time, looking at Philippians 3:4-9.